This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 40 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please leave a rating, review, share, subscribe, you know, whatever you guys want to do to, you know, get the word out there. I am loving the feedback that I've been getting, from people all over the place. It just blows my mind that, you know, people are really that into the show. And, it's a testament to the support that I've gotten from, you know, a lot of my followers and listeners, but, also the guests that I've been able to have on and, you know, their willingness to come on and spend their time, you know, imparting their wisdom on, you guys and me, quite frankly, because I learn a lot every time I have someone on. And I'm just really happy that I'm able to, you know, kind of share some of the connections I've been able to make in the industry, whether it's, you know, strength training, baseball, sports performance in general, just the fact that I've been able to share the connections I've made and allow these people to come on and, kind of give their insights and thoughts on a lot of important topics just means a lot to me. So I'm just thrilled you guys are enjoying it. As I speak, we're about to hit 20,000 overall downloads on the show. I can't even believe that. The episodes are pulling like 600-700, a show in the first like month, which is just insane. I can't even fathom that. To the amount of countries, the cities and everything that are, you know, listening, just fantastic. So thank you. Really thank you for that. Shout out to my Yankees, setting up to take on the Minnesota Twins Friday at 7 p.m. at Yankee Stadium. Big time of year for your boy. Very, very big Yankee fan. So as you guys check back each week, you'll get an idea of how they're doing based on, how I'm feeling. So if they're doing poorly, expect to me, I'll be a little sad. So hopefully not. Twins are going to be tough. And if we get past them, I'd assume we'll play the Astros based on how things look. And they're going to be very tough as well. So fingers crossed, let's hope for a good postseason for the Yankees. Before, I get into today's show, Kevin Poppy, thrilled to have Kevin on, very, very smart guy, works with a lot of professional athletes, and interestingly enough is very similar in the sense of my background that, he did not go to school for exercise science, kinesiology, had a bit of an unconventional entrance into the industry. So we're getting his perspective on that at the end of the show. But before that, we're talking a bunch of different things, talking that, never ending debate of the strong enough and, when it comes time to, maybe put less emphasis on barbell strength and how Kevin goes about assessing that and making those decisions. Talking speed, all the, philosophies and principles of speed, rate of force and force development, how to build both, the importance of strength, a strength base and relative strength when it comes to acceleration and the first two strides, killing that rumor of quick feet. We're talking baseball starts, specifically, why the crossover step, isn't the way to go and, why you should stop teaching it and kind of, all things, to do with the drop and the fall step and the benefits, to stride angle and, the center of mass positioning and linear force production and all that good stuff. Then we're getting a little bit into in-season training and conditioning, recovery, arm care, and how it deals with the entire body, all that good stuff right there. And then kind of, funny enough, Kevin tells me, hey, I share that similar background that you do, not going to school for this stuff. And I had no idea. So you're going to kind of hear that funny moment where I was kind of like, oh shit, like no clue that that was a thing. So pretty cool that we vibe on that. And, he's just a brilliant dude and we kind of hit it off for an awesome discussion that I think you guys are going to love. So, I hope you guys enjoy. Hit me with whatever feedback that you have as usual. And again, I reiterate the ratings and the reviews are super helpful. So if you're enjoying, just, do me a solid and leave me one of those, tweet me, DM me, whatever it is, any questions or feedback that you have. Enjoy this episode with Kevin. He was awesome. You guys are going to love it. Hope you guys learned something. Till next time. Thanks. Peace. All right, everyone, I'd like to welcome on Kevin Poppy. Kev, thanks so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate your time. Excited to have you.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for having me on.
It's been a pleasure. I know we've been going back and forth on Twitter for a while now and have a lot of respect for what you do and We kind of click on a lot of, like, you know, I guess how we can do things with training and kind of how we conceptualize everything. So excited to have you and, you know, kind of chop it up and see what we come up with.
Likewise, man. I'm excited to get talking for you.
So what I wanted to start with, and I've kind of touched on this topic with a couple guests, but it's super important, and I'd like to get everyone's perspective on it. I posted a video about a month ago. Obviously, the listeners who will know, but you and I had a great exchange on it. It was that one I did about the quote-unquote strong enough, right? You know, when it comes to barbell strength, and you posted a really, really great thread, you know, in response to that. And I kind of wanted to just get, you know, your take on that whole thing right off the bat and then kind of get into some specifics. But, when you hear strong enough, like, how do you, like, what's your breakdown on that and what that means?
It's a good question. The way I think about it and the way, I mean, I know we talk about it at DST is that, A lot of people are concerned about whether they're strong enough already or blah, 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 blah. And those are usually the people that, I guess, lack requisite strength already. So those are usually the only people that are actually concerned about it. But, you know, a lot of people that point to the strong enough, like they'll say, hey, once your max strength is at a certain point, you experience diminishing returns. But a lot of that's based on studies used with shot putters where their bench press maxes were up in 400s. So one of my thoughts right out the gate is, okay, no one I've ever trained has probably come near, the threshold of being too strong, if you will.
Okay.
So people that say there's like no way strength's ever a weakness. Well, I would disagree, but I would think it's highly, 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 highly unlikely anyone that anybody works with is going to get to that point. And then secondarily, and I see this echoed a lot, is that they'll say, well, you know, if sport movement needs to happen in 0.9 seconds or 1 point, whatever people point to as the threshold. So they point to rate of force development being more of the key as opposed to overall force.
Yep.
Well, while that's true, obviously we know that if we can make a certain force production sub-maximal, then we're going to achieve greater rate of force development with that force. So if I think one of the studies with the shot putters was that they can translate 135 pounds to the ball. Okay. Well, that, or to the shot. So that doesn't mean that they should stop working at 135 pounds and that everything else is just extra. What it means is that the more strength we can gain on top of that,
yes,
the quicker we can move that. So I like to tell people, if I one rep max on my deadlift at 400 pounds, I'm going to move that incredibly slow. But if I can increase my max, let's say, to 500 pounds, then I go back to 400, I'm probably going to be able to move that a heck of a lot faster than I did when it was my one rep max.
Yep.
So that's kind of my thought on it is, like, you know, I think people, especially in the athletic realm, worry about it more than they should.
Yeah, for sure.
On the other hand, I think, you know, I do have some, let's say, some baseball guys that can rip up 600 pounds, and it's not to say that that's a bad thing at all or that he spent too much time working on strength, but my thing at that point becomes, okay, I have a 5-month off season. This guy can lift this. Is this really his biggest constraint now? So my job is identifying constraints of the athlete and attacking those to make them more overall athletic, right? So if I can attack a weakness and make it stronger, then they're going to experience more gains from that athletically. And if they're able to rip up 500-600 pounds off the floor, then, you know, that's probably not the constraint that I need to be targeting. Probably strength isn't what's holding them back.
Yeah.
So it's not that I'm worried about them being too strong. It's just that, is it really their biggest need right now? And so that's kind of my thought process when it comes to the strong enough, is that most, you know, when I'm talking about it more, is with our high school athletes. Their parents come in, they say, I don't, you know, he doesn't need to be super strong or super big. And I'm like, well, you know, you're right. However,
he's nowhere near that threshold.
Yeah. No, just nowhere near it.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you're worrying about stuff that I would love to have that conversation. If we get there, if we ever have that conversation of, hey, your kid's getting too big or too strong.
We're in a good spot. Yeah.
We're in a great spot, because that's just means we can graduate to another topic. We can start working on the finer qualities, the, you know, whether it's the eccentric utilization or reactive strength or whatever you want to work on at that point. We just don't need to spend as much time on strength anymore.
For sure. I think that, you know, we've all as strength coaches, like I could sit here for 3 hours and tell you about the countless things that have been said to me by parents that bewilder me. But
yeah, unreal.
Like we see it all the time on social media, like kids and parents just, they get bombarded with a bunch of stuff that they see pro athletes doing. And some of it's even good stuff. Like I'm not even talking about like the ridiculous videos that we, you know, we saw over the summer with the Antonio Browns of the world, or, you know, Alvin Kamara catching like different colored sticks while standing on a BOSU ball. Like obviously we know that stuff is eyewash, and, you know, there's better ways to spend your time and all that kind of stuff. And I don't want to beat a dead horse with that, but, even the good stuff, like, you know, take it as far as, like, I tell people all the time, if you see something that I'm doing, you know, if I have a 13-year-old coming to me and they see a video of something that like a 20-year-old is doing with me that's been training for 6 years, like, you don't need that right now. Like, and you're probably not going to for a while. And it's tough to like make the parents understand that, like, we're doing you a favor and we're doing you we'd be doing you a disservice if we had you do that right now. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. There's two analogies that we like to use. And one that I got from my good friend Pete, he was one of my mentors when I first started up with DSC, but he uses a math analogy a lot. I like to communicate a lot in analogies, because if we try to just technical jargon people to death, they're going to shut down and they're not going to internalize what we're saying. And we're just trying to make ourselves sound smarter. So yeah. Usually when we try to communicate at DST, we'll use a lot of analogies. So what Pete used to say is like, okay, that guy's doing trigonometry. You know, ask him what he was doing at 8, 9, 10 years old. He was doing addition, subtraction, learning some multiplication. But you can't expect to, if I just throw, okay, this kid, the parent comes in and says they want their kid to do trigonometry. All right, well, let's throw trigonometry at him and watch the kid just sit there and cry because he doesn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
You got to build, you can't do trigonometry without having an understanding of addition, subtraction, multiplication, division,
and all that.
And it's a process, and you just need to lay the right tools down first. And so, like, first and foremost needs to be movement and discipline and tempo, and then you build from there. And another analogy we use is, you know, I always hate when people compare what they're doing to another person anyway. So our whole assessment process is to find out how to individualize to you.
Yeah.
And so it's to the point in not at all comparing what we do to being a doctor, but the analogy holds is that if I have two different diagnoses, the same medicine probably isn't going to have the same result. So if someone comes to me and says, oh, I'm bringing you my son because you worked with this guy, or, you know, this guy trained here or whatever, and I want you to do what you did with him. Well, okay. Well, that guy had a very different need than your son. So even if they are the same age, like, they might need different things. If it's a headache, we're going to prescribe Tylenol. If it's cancer, you know, there's chemotherapy, and you don't want to be taking chemo for a headache, you know?
Yeah. Don't treat high cholesterol with open heart surgery, right? Like,
exactly.
Maybe change your diet a little bit and start simpler, and like, we don't have to open up your chest right away.
Right. So don't compare yourself to any other person in the first place, according to your needs. But at the same time, with the pro athletes, like, you understand that there's levels you have to go through. And as youth athletes, even before high school, there's sensitive periods that they're going through. And so one of our guys here, Jordan Ainsworth, he talks about it a lot, is that, you know, when the athlete's 8 to 10 years old, they can really hone in on their movement quality, reaction time, reaction to auditory and visual cues. 10 to 13, you can work on your balance, muscle extensibility, and strength endurance. And 13 to 15, you can start building more of that speed strength and max strength quality. And then aside from that is, with these high school athletes, our job as strength coaches is to identify the biggest constraint, right? So if we can identify where they need improvement, then we can help them. And with our pro athletes, it becomes a little more varied. With our pro college athletes, it's a little more varied what they need. But with our high school athletes, it's 95% of the time, it's you're too small and you're too weak.
Yeah.
You don't have enough force. You just get bigger and stronger right now.
It's really easy to fill those buckets for them because there's nothing in them.
Mm-hmm. It's not a general program. It's specific to you. It's just you happen to specifically need what a lot of other guys need too.
Yes, that's a really good way to. I've never actually put it that way. It's like you said, like, just because, you know, you're doing a lot of the same stuff that you see others in the, you know, facility doing, or other people that you just know your age, like kids like to talk and who's doing what, and, oh, I'm lifting this way or you're lifting that way. But like you said, just because, you know, you're doing it and a lot of others are, doesn't mean it's not specific to you. It just means that a lot of people your age probably end up needing that.
Right. It's just how it is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. It's like you said, like it's crazy, you know, barring like major things with the youth athlete, whether it's like a movement dysfunction or, you know, something that like is really glaring with them, like they're going to need a lot of the same, like 9.9 out of 10 13 year olds. And I know you can't have a fraction of a 13 year old, but you know what I mean? Don't need anything but just like to just get strong and just move better through movement patterns. Like it doesn't have to be, like you said, trigonometry right away. So that's beautifully said on that point for sure.
I appreciate that. And like going off of what our exchange on Twitter, I think that time I explained, I've been doing this 9 years. DST has been around over 11 years now. And I, in my experience, have seen maybe 4 or 5 high school kids tops that didn't really need to worry about gaining mass or strength. There's very few. And so if we're having that conversation, you're in the top 0.5%. So let's not even worry about it. If you're kind of a middle of the pack guy, we need to get bigger and stronger now.
Yeah.
When you get to college pro and we start achieving some of that lean mass and max strength quality that we need, then we can start talking about other things.
Yeah, absolutely. It even comes to the point of like, you know, the whole reason we have, you know, we test athletes and we have a, you know, system of metrics, whatever they are, like I'm not even getting into the specifics. Like a trainer might use a broad jump. I use a vertical. A trainer might use a 10 yard sprint and I use a 20, whatever it is. Like that aside, you know, at the end of the day, if we're improving those numbers, then they're going to keep on keeping on with whatever attributes we're trying to hone in on and get better. Right. So like,
right.
If I have an athlete and I use him as an example a lot, like, you know, he was, you know, front squatting 350 pounds, you know, vertical jump, maybe like 30, 31 on the mat we were using, and, or let's say 30. And now it's a 32 and change with not really driving up that number much at all. I'm going to say to myself, well, okay, maybe he, you know, that 350 was all he, you know, needed. There was more things we could work on versus like, if we stopped hammering the 350 and now he's down to a 28, I'm going to say, okay, maybe we have to, you know, keep on getting strong. It's a really easy way to go about it. Right.
Right. Yeah. Just using any measurables that you can to quantify results. And we talk about it all the time is we'll program a 4-week phase. But if the athlete's still seeing results at the end of that 4 weeks, there's nothing wrong in just extending that phase.
Yes, yes.
You don't have to just you don't have to just move on to the next phase of periodization. So it's just because you have this like plan is like they might be responding heavily to an eccentric phase. Okay, keep them on eccentrics until we're not seeing returns anymore.
Yeah, I know. Especially I could definitely admit to this as a young coach, and even sometimes now, like I've gotten better at this, which I was happy to hear you say that. Like, how many times we think coming into the profession and, you know, getting experience that you have to like sometimes change things just to change them. Because if you don't, you're lazy or you're not like, you know, making the next move, whatever it is. Like you make that example. Like I had a 13, 14 year old athlete, you know, in the facility and running, like, let's just say the same, we were doing loaded jumps, right? Running the same percentage of like load for those for, you know, 6 weeks, and they went up, you know, an inch and a half on the vertical. I'm like, why would I stop that? I want to see if it would still improve. And we did it again and it went up another inch. So it's like, that was the right move. Like people, I feel like too many young coaches and those who listen to this who want to become coaches, feel like they have to make a move just to do it or just because they're going to be a bad coach if they don't, where, like you said, sometimes the best thing is to just keep on going with what's working.
Right. I mean, I couldn't have said any better than that. We all do it as coaches, and it's one of those things where we're still working on it too. I know I'm guilty of it all the time, even with our pro athletes, is they're responding heavily to a phase and, you know, you just moved them on to the next phase because it was in the plan. But
yes,
instead of stepping back and not getting caught up in the plan and just saying, okay, maybe we just go off plan now and we adjust the plan from here on out and we'll ride this until, especially in speed programming is where I've had a problem with it the most is, you know, we're getting an athlete responding heavily on a speed phase and we move to the next phase because it's the next bigger, better thing, but then they don't respond to that as well as they were before. So just keep them going. Just keep them going if you're seeing results and then change it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, it's like one of those things too. You know, I feel like there's so much pressure now, and I'm saying this directed at the coaches who listen. I have a lot of listeners who will like reach out to me after an episode and say, hey, like, you know, two episodes ago, I talked to the guests about like learning and being, it's okay to, you know, be incorrect. That's how you're going to get better. And a couple have reached out and said, hey, like, it meant a lot to hear you guys say that, 'cause like, I'm just getting in the field. And I think there's a lot of pressure on coaches to like push for that next shiny new thing, whatever it is, because they feel like you said, like they have to, like, I could, you know, detail an entire summer, you know, off season for my hockey guys, of like my college guys, like what we're going to plan on doing. And maybe we don't get to that one thing halfway through and they're like, oh, I thought we were going to switch. And I'm like, well, guys, if you're, you know, hammering out insane results on whatever we're trying to achieve, like, why would I change it just because I had it originally? So I think that's really important for a lot of the listeners who are young coaches, like, don't get caught up in that. And like, if you have to stick to, you know, what is being done that's working, like, it's okay.
Right. I mean, everyone wants to portray themselves as gurus from time to time, but really, you know, the good coaches, none of us are gurus. None of the coaches here at DST are gurus or try to profess to be. What we're trying to do is improve day to day. And so when you can identify a point where you're not doing your best, you know, then we can grow from it and build on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, if you have the testing there, that's all you need to fall back on at the end of the day. Like, if you're conflicted on what's the right thing to do, go back to those numbers, and that's going to really, you know, swing you in that way. There's a lot of, you know, talk in baseball and arguments about data this, data that, who's using it wrong, right, whatever. But there's no disputing in strength and sports performance and speed training that, like, we have to let ourselves be dictated by the numbers when it comes to, you know, knowing what our programming should be and what we should be doing going forward. There's no other way to say it.
100%. Couldn't agree more.
So I don't know if you remember this, but we were in another exchange. We've been in a bunch of different, I guess it's because like we have a lot of the same thought process on things and we agree on a lot. So we end up getting like in a lot of different threads and all that kind of stuff. But we had an exchange one time. I don't know if it was someone reached out to both of us and tagged us in it, asking us the same question or what it was. It was about like trap bar deadlift maxes. And someone basically was asking the both of us what the most we had seen in our respective facilities with like the athletes we've worked with. I remember, I don't know what the exact number was, but you mentioned that you had never had someone be over a certain amount because you had just found that like once they got there, it didn't really, kind of like what we talked about, didn't yield, you know, that next, the gains for them and whatever it was you were trying to achieve. And I think it was an NFL guy. You might have been, what was it, Joik Bell? Have you worked with him?
Oh, no.
It was Javid Best. I'm trying to think of who the hell the guy was.
So I remember this exchange exactly. And the guy you were talking about was Ben Tate. And,
Ben Tate. I'm sorry. I named about three different running backs. Couldn't think of who the hell it was.
That's all right. For the record, never worked with any of those guys. So to answer your question, I remember this exchange vividly because what it was somebody had posted a video of a trap bar deadlift of somebody pulling up 600 or it was a good amount.
It was like 8 reps, right? It was like something crazy.
Yeah. And it was something like 600 pounds or 590 or it was some absurd number. And, somebody, and this is one of my biggest pet peeves on social media, somebody did the comment of it's not a real deadlift. So it's not that impressive.
Yes. I hate that. Oh my God.
And I was like, man, I don't know who you think you are, but yes, that is impressive. Yes. He's still moving that weight, is he not? So my main point is I've been doing this 9 years. In my time, I've never seen anybody, I've seen very few people actually get over the like 525. Like a lot of people get up to around the 500 mark, but I've seen very few people get above that. And partially because even when we have our hex bars, like our hex bars are kind of on our older hex bars are kind of on the smaller end and we use a lot of bumper plates. So you just can't fit that much weight on there in the first place. But two, like going back to what we said before, I've always seen it as, and I was taught, so Leif Yoki was my mentor and he's the head strength coach of the Los Angeles Angels. And I was always taught like, if they're moving weight really quickly, but they're still lacking in a certain area, or if they're moving a lot of weight and they can move it quickly, but they're still lacking in other areas, maybe we should be exploring what they're lacking as opposed to what they're already good at. So if someone's deadlifting 5-something or whatever it is, like they're pretty good at that. Let's see if there's other areas. And if they're not, if they're just really good at everything, okay, let's just keep getting stronger and do what we need to do. But my point was that, you know, the heaviest people I can remember deadlifting thing. There was Ben Tate, and you know, I only worked with Ben for like an off season, and it was really Lee Fiocchi was working with him, and then Kyle Kleeman, who runs our NFL Combine training at our Houston Christian or DST West facility.
Yep.
They both worked with him a lot. I remember that dude loading up a lot of weight on the hex bar, and I never saw him get above 600 pounds, but I did see him rep out 515 for 12 reps or whatever it was. Key Brian Hayes, he's a prospect with the Pirates in our North facility up here. I posted a video on that thread. Was he pulled 600 pounds, which is our facility record, and it's not like they aren't strong people, you know. So we're not trying to build power lifters. I don't care if it passes in a meet. I don't care if hex bar is a qualified version of a deadlift. What I care about is chasing adaptation and a response to the stimulus. So if I want to load up the athlete heavy, the best way to do it, in my opinion, is going to be a hex bar or a sumo deadlift, depending on the specific adaptation that I'm trying to go for. It's kind of like if I'm trying to add the most stress I can to someone in a squat, a front squat's not the way to do it. So a front squat is great for its own reasons, but you're limited on your load.
Yep.
So if you're really trying to stress the central nervous system too, and not just think about the specific exercise you're trying to get the athlete to perform, if you're trying to chase a response, you know, it leads to hips. And so hex bars are money in training, and there's loads of research to back up the transfer to sports specificity, if you will. You know, even though I hate using those terms, but you know, basically to answer your question, my big thing is a hex bar deadlift is absolutely a legitimate deadlift. I would say in training for sport, one of my takes that I always say is I think it's more applicable than any sort of conventional deadlift, especially for athletes, and not just athletic movement, but most athletes' builds. Like, they're able to get into better positions for the hex bar or sumo. And so it ends up being a better way to load, because I'm not trying to build a better weight room warrior. I'm trying to help them become better athletes. And so one is the hex bar. Absolutely. It annoyed me that anyone would say that's not a good tool, or trap bar, or whatever you want to call it. But then two is we've worked with a lot of strong guys at DST, a lot of really strong, powerful guys. Ben Tate, known as a power runner, and I never saw anything like that. It's impressive. I don't care. Like, none, that guy who commented on it, there's no way he can get under the bar and do that.
No, of course not.
It's just that's one of my things, and it just comes to the point for me of the reason people don't get that is, you know, at DST we work with a lot of football and baseball players, so we just don't have the time in the off season. And for the, let's say, the NFL guys, when Kyle's working with them, is they have a month here, a month there. They don't have a real big off season because they have camp and they got OTAs, and so they're already really strong, and you're not going to outstrength someone on the NFL field. They're all really strong. So you need to separate yourself in other ways and maintain that strength. But, you know, picking up 700 pounds isn't what they need. And then a professional baseball player, we've got 5 months to develop a plethora of skills. And one of those is max strength. But, you know, if max strength is the specific need that this athlete needs for the whole off season, he's probably not getting to the point of pulling 650 off the ground. And if someone is getting to that point, maybe it's better for us to start focusing on different need. And that was my main point there, is that we don't even get to that point. But even if we tried to, there aren't a lot of people that can do that.
No, of course not. People, I mean, listen, that's like one of the pitfalls of social media. You know, we deal with it all the time and see things that are just said that are just idiotic. Mm-hmm. Just without any understanding of like what it takes to lift that weight. I don't care where the handles are, where it's located, how you want to argue joint angles and force applique. I could care less. The fact that someone can pull 600 pounds off the floor, no matter what it is impressive. And like you said, I doubt that guy could do it. You brought up a great point before, and I actually just thought of something that I wanted to kind of mention. Thinking about, like you said, 5 months, like, right? Like, if you had a pro guy come in, baseball player, they had 5 months to get back, you know, ready for, you know, spring training or for the season or whatever it is. You know, mentioning that, hey, we're going to want to build some strength. But, you know, you mentioned before, like, if I can get a guy to, you know, go from, let's say, 450 or 500 pounds on the trap bar where they're moving it very slow, but maybe that max goes up to 550, where now it's a lesser percentage of their actual max and they can move it faster, right? But maybe thinking along the lines, you know, of, hey, I only have 5 months. What's going to get me a faster training effect? Building up 75 pounds on a max, or maybe staying and doing 450, emphasizing, you know, the bar speed, so to speak, to build more of that rate of force with those higher loads. And I think it just speaks to your point of like, how much time do you have? And like, yes, it's a quality we want to work on, but are there other ways that, you know, we could achieve that quality that are a little more expedient?
Oh yeah, for sure. So we talk about this. We try to periodize our off season as best we can, but we're always making adjustments, right? So just kind of going to that point and just explaining our thought process on our off season training is, you know, the first phase that we always go through is movement restoration, and it's movement restoration and building a slight aerobic ability. And so one of those things that we do is we do our assessment and we see where they're limited, what imbalances they've developed. A baseball is inherently one-sided sport, so they almost predictively have certain imbalances. And so what we try to do is hammer those at the beginning of the off season, and then all of them have been playing for 6 months and have, for the most part, they always come back to us a little weaker than they left. So we're trying to build up max strength. But then there's other qualities that go into an athlete. It's not just strength, right? So it's their ability to contract and relax at a quick rate. It's their ability to eccentrically load, absorb, and reapply. And so there's different ways to go about training for those effects, but really, like, our max strength type training, like, we don't do much concentric emphasis training, mainly because the force production, the areas in the sport where they're experiencing the most, like, the most force at a sudden moment is through an eccentric means of some kind. So we like to focus a lot on our isometrics and eccentrics as well. Max strength is a part of the formula, but how quickly the athlete can decelerate force, focusing, you know, using the isometrics and the plyometric type exercises to focus on the connective tissue, the tendon, the extracellular matrix within the muscle. And that all plays a huge role in sport. And I think it just gets oversimplified that when we're training, we're strength. And it's like, well, yes, we want to train strength, but there are so many more things that go in. And, you know, I think I heard even on this podcast, you had was it Stephen Jones, right?
Yes.
And he was alluding to the idea that a lot of these forces are happening within 30 milliseconds. They're in an elite sprinter, they're absorbing 10 times their body weight in the first 30 milliseconds. And that's going to be heavily biased toward the tendon. And so what we can bias our training, not just toward the muscle quality and the strength and absolute strength of the tissue and in certain movements, but also working on those, I guess you could call them qualities as well. That all needs to happen in one off season. And so being able to balance that's kind of the trick, is being able to find where you need to push on one guy and where this guy needs to go in a different direction. So an example I would give, it's always a it depends answer, right? So with each athlete, it comes with different things. So I have an athlete come in, it's 190 pounds professional athlete, and he's extremely weak. Well, force production needs to be one of his main focuses. I've got another guy comes in, and he comes in better shape than most people leave at. And his name is Brian Brickhouse. He was with the Royals organization, and this is a good example, is that he's really strong, but there are other qualities that would I guess – that we would want to focus on through his off season. So his off season is going to be a little less volume, a little less progression toward max strength, because he's got a ton of it. But moving more toward movement patterns, specific loading, isometrics, reactive strength, and more of that, focusing on the elasticity of the athlete. So that's kind of the thought process. But even generally, we try to build up the strength and through isometrics and eccentric means, and then build into our speed strength and ballistic. And I mean, yeah, bar speed is a big part of it. We use the Tendo, we use VBT, but it's just another tool in the tool belt. And so it's how are you implementing it with the specific athlete and what they need. So instead of chasing a 700-pound deadlift and risking a movement quality dysfunction that leads to an injury, or even risking just moving slowly all the time, working on moving a specific load faster, like you just said, that's a big thing you can chase through an off season and be competitive with it. Yep. And get better results than just trying to pull weight, which there could be a lot of links in the chain that are too weak. So it might not be a lower half power reason they can't lift the weight. It might be a grip strength. It might be rotator cuff issue that is leading to a grip issue. And so you can't even work higher strength, but you can still work at a lower strength threshold and work on moving it quicker. You know, there's different ways to go about it.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's also a great point right at the end, what you mentioned too, like, we're not training Olympic lifters. We're not training power lifters. Like I tell people, I mean, there could be, you know, certain circumstances where we do, of course, but, in terms of athletes, like people say to me all the time, like, what are your opinions on straps? Like on a front squat, let's just say, like, I'm not training one of my hockey players to be an Olympic front squatter, like in a competition. So if, you know, they have a wrist issue or, you know, something just that is not comfortable for them to, you know, hold a typical rack position when we're getting up to higher weights and it limits them in what we're trying to do, like, of course I'm going to let them use straps because it's going to help us get, you know, in a position to expose them to a load that they might not otherwise be able to do in that traditional sense. So the same thing goes for the deadlift. Like, if there's a grip issue or something along those lines, like, I mean, I've never really had athletes use straps for a deadlift, but like, if it came up, you know, where it was necessary, you know, you'd be dumb not to, in my opinion, because like, you're going to limit what the legs are able to do and what you're trying to get in terms of that training effect if the grip is, you know, that limiting factor.
Right. And so like, I'm with you. I've rarely, if ever, had anybody really strap up a deadlift because, you know, if you can't, you know, I understand the old quote that if you can't grip it, you can't lift it. But like, it's just one of those things. If you can't lift it, and then instead of like trying to bypass a weakness, which might be an indicator of something deeper, let's maybe change the stimulus a little bit. And so that's where I would go to maybe even a different exercise.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like you said, we're not trying to like create Olympic lifters or power lifters necessarily, unless that's their sport. What we're trying to do is create adaptation. So yeah, you know what? We elevate a deadlift too. And that's going to like make people's ears bleed, but we'll elevate a deadlift. We'll do half squats too. We'll do quarter squats. Like it's all about what we're trying to chase. What adaptation are we trying to get out of the exercise? It's not about the exercise.
For sure. Yeah. And it's also like, how are you doing those quarter and those half squats? There's a difference between, you know, Johnny Instagram going on and doing 405 and saying, oh, 405 club today and doing a half rep, you know, and putting his knees in jeopardy versus like Max Schmarzo, Strong by Science on his episode said this, and I've kind of taken this with me too, like, how are you applying it? So there's a difference between, you know, Johnny Instagram doing 405 for a half squat versus like a sprinter putting a plate and a 10 on and doing a half squat for max speed, like with bands on the side for accommodated resistance, like going through that extension. Like there's a gigantic difference in that. So people, you might say people's ears are going to bleed when they hear that, but they shouldn't, because they need to understand, like, you're not having someone do a quarter or a half squat because they're, you know, doing a weight they can't handle and not, you know, able to get depth on it. They're doing it because you're loading it in a unique fashion that's going to help them in what particular way you're trying to help them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I just think like people get too caught up in like these rules of strength conditioning, where if you weren't like the whole reason there are rules in the first place is because that's where strength conditioning developed, is through, you know, powerlifting and Olympic lifting. And so that, of course, that's kind of like an underlying thing. But if you understand that, hey, listen, like Olympic lifting, do I have a problem with it? No, I like Olympic lifting. However, I'm not going to have a lot of my baseball players do it. One, because I don't have enough time for them to get any real adaptation out of an off season doing it, because I have to teach it for most of the off season. And then two is I can get, if I can identify why I like Olympic lifts. So if I can identify, most coaches will try to identify triple extension, the sudden eccentric load, the high speed eccentric, the body coordination and space. Okay. If I can identify those are the reasons I like it, well, I can get those same adaptations somewhere else. And I don't have to spend 90% of the offseason teaching a technical lift that, yeah, it looks cool and everything, but it's not a good use of my time.
Yeah, for sure. It's like anything. Like, let me ask you this. If
an athlete walked into your gym, you know, whatever sport it was, and you found out for whatever reason that like a traditional prowler push was gonna get the, you know, let's just say that, you know, let's say it's a high school athlete that needs to get their 7.2 down to a 6.95 to get their scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. And for some reason, we find out that, you know, the training effect they're going to get out of pushing a heavy prowler on their, you know, heavier day and moving a prowler for, you know, lighter weight for speed on their lighter day is going to be more effective for them than the, you know, traditional trap bar means that may be used for other athletes. Like, it'd be ridiculous to say you wouldn't do that. Like, right. It doesn't have to be. Everyone gets so caught up in, like you said, like, I get it. There are always going to be principles we adhere to. Like, in the same sense, we say it's, you don't always have to be traditional. We're going to refer back to those traditional means to tell you why it's like not good to stand on a BOSU ball balancing, you know, dumbbells in your hand. But like, there's a time and place.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And so that's just it, is if you can identify, if you have strong backing to say this method is why we're doing this, then you'd be dumb to not change your method to accommodate. So just an example, just like using what you just used there, is that we've used the prowler a lot in our programming in the past. And we've done speed prowler sprints. Well, a lot of the research we're looking at now is showing that like at a certain rate of decrease, like once the weight is light enough to where it's not affecting a heavy decrease in speed. So like 85% above, if it's not affecting that kind of a decrease in speed, if it's 75% decrease, under, so if it's 25 to 75% decrease in speed of their max sprint, then it, you know, a lot of the research is pointing to towing a sled is going to be more beneficial as opposed to over the really heavy work, the over 75% decrease in absolute speed when you load it. It's showing that pushing it's going to be better because you're creating it applies more to your start power, your instantaneous power. And you get more horizontal force production, whereas when you're dealing with 75% under decreases in speed, towing is going to be better because you can incorporate the arms. It's more effective for our sprint mechanics. And one of our coaches, who's only been with us for a year, brought it to our attention. So it was Kevin Williams and Hayden Letts at our North Campus brought it to my attention. And I've always done light prowler sprints with our pitchers, and now I'm changing that to where if we're doing light sprints, so I'm towing the sled. And it's just, if you see reason to change a method, regardless of if it's traditional or not, you should change it to chase adaptation as opposed to your ego or your traditional values.
Yeah, and it just goes back to like if you have to have ways to know what's working, what's not working. And actually, we're gonna get into the specifics of speed. So it's a good segue because you mentioned like pushing a heavier prowler versus towing it. You know, working on like those first two strides and the base of strength and relative strength and starting strength when it comes to like getting going, so to speak. And you know, people think of it as, you know, that quick feet mantra that goes around, and it's like, well, no, like, you have to be able to put adequate force into the ground to propel yourself, you know, and get yourself going. It's been shown that that's like the main, you know, way to improve that. And if, you know, pushing the sled is better for that, then, you know, and I've seen it with my own guys for sure. But, you know, if I'm going to work more on like an actual length, a longer sprint, they're going to pull it. And if it's, you know, something that's very, very short in distance, the push is probably going to come along. So I think that's a great point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just going into what you just said there with the quick feet and force production to the ground is, you know, with everything in strength conditioning, there are very, very few laws. And a lot of people, including myself, trash like quick feet stuff from time to time, but usually because it's just misapplied and misunderstood.
Yes.
It's like, is there a place for being able to control your feet and being able to have that kind of movement adequacy and being able to contract and relax and ground contact time? Absolutely, there's a place for it, but it's not doing what you think it's doing to the broad population. So it's not a means of affecting agility. It's not a means of affecting change of direction and quickness. It just is what it is. It's coordination and maybe like a warm up, CNS priming. But it's for lack of a better way to put it, it's simply coordination. When I tell people all the time, when we're trying to work on cuts or jukes or anything like that, any change of direction stuff, if I try to relate it to a football field, I can have the quickest juke in the world, but if I don't cover ground out of that juke, I'm still going to get lit the heck up. So, like, I got to be able to cover ground, which means I have to be able to push force on the ground as hard as I can in as short a period of time as I can to cover as much ground as I can in as short a period of time as I can without getting off the ground as high as I can. And that, I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yep, absolutely, yeah. I think, like you said, you know, the reason at least I get upset about it is, like you said, about misapplied science. Like, if you just took a second to understand what's actually going into speed and let someone actually explain it to you, it just makes too much sense to ever use that terminology ever again. Like, you know, Joe DeFranco said, you know, chasing the adaptation of going nowhere fast, right? So looking like Fred Flintstone, you know, kind of revving his feet up all once and just, you know, bang, shooting off from there. Like, it doesn't work that way. You know, the faster runner is, you know, covering more ground and less strides. And it's, again, you know, not really even dictated by the feet. It's the hips, the ankles, the knees, like that you mentioned, triple extension, moving through that process that's guiding the feet. The feet aren't an independent entity that are working on their own. Like, it seems like that, but it's, no, they're being driven by the engine, which is through the legs.
Exactly. And so it's just going back to even what we talked about earlier, when parents or athletes come in like, well, I don't really need to work in the weight room too much, or my kid really just needs to work on his speed. And it's a 13-year-old, 6-foot kid at 135 pounds. So he really just is slow. So we really want him working on his speed. I'm like, listen, you can have all the technique you want in the world, but two things are going to happen here. Like, one, the reason he's not fast is because he can't apply force into the ground. And so I can already look at this kid and tell you, like, one of his biggest constraints is going to be force production into the ground to actually propel his body forward. So he's got to be able to produce force and propel his body forward. Secondarily is that, you know, even with technical work, you're going to have limits because, you know, it's like when people tell athletes to try to stay low in their start. And it's, some people should hear that, but most people don't need to hear that because it causes them to hunch down. And we're talking about a bent spine now, and it's not an effective body lean. But the body lean is going to be dictated by your head position and your force production into the ground. The greater force production you're going to be able to have in a short period of time, the better your body lean is going to be. So if we're talking about athletes that want to work on speed, I just think it's misunderstood is that strength is a huge component of speed. It's especially in the start, but overall, like, I try to tell people, like, in the start, you think about you're spinning a basketball on your fingers, right? You're not trying to be real quick and choppy when you start spinning the basketball. You have to have a couple big, long spins, and then you can start being quick off the ball, just like keeping it going, tap, tap, tap. It's the same thing with speed. You can't just try to be chop, chop feet right out of the gate. What we need to do is apply force. You got to be long and strong through the ground, have a great front side mechanic with your knee drive, and then attack the ground. And as you get going, you know, it's going to be quicker and quicker and quicker. But the start is pretty much how much force can you put in the ground and how quickly can you do it?
Yeah, exactly. And you said, like, it's not that quick, choppy, like, get off the ground, like, get off the line quick. It's, you know, and that's the thing people don't understand either, is like how much you're limiting the force that's being put into those strides when you try to make them too fast and too quick and choppy, right? Like,
yeah.
It's like, you know, you push the gas down on the Ferrari and it's about to literally take off, and then you hit the brake real quick.
Yeah.
Like, you haven't even let that stride, like, unravel and do what it's supposed to do, so to speak.
Yeah, and we always see this with youth athletes too. So when I say youth in this case, I mean like high school, middle school, and high school athletes. It's just always that kid that looks like he's running really fast, but then you put him on a timer and he's really just average, if not below average. And then you got the kid that doesn't look like he's moving very quick because he's tall and gangly, but he covers ground. And it's one of those things. It's like, do you want to look like you're running, moving fast, or do you want to actually cover ground? And as an athlete, you're always going to actually want to cover ground.
Yeah, yep. It's just, I just like the Fred Flintstone thing is, to me, resonated for me, especially like thinking of the idea that, you know, moving the feet quicker, so to speak. I bring up Joe DeFranco all the time, and, you know, he mentions, I think it was, Jim Finn, the longtime fullback for the Giants years ago, he worked with, and, you know, he got his 10-yard speed down, and I think he took a stride and a half off, you know,
the number of strides it took for him to get that 10 yards covered, you know, mm-hmm. it's just, the proof is there. Like mm-hmm. if it's point A to point B, the quickest way to get there is the least amount of one movement. So obviously if you're linear, like, you know, you want to stay linear to cover that ground, but two is, you know, allowing those strides to do what they're supposed to do and get where they're supposed to get to. You know, and inevitably, like you said, the way to get that is just to be, you know, getting stronger and putting more force into the ground and, you know, obviously sprinting and sprinting fast, right? Like, you know, we're going to get to this in a little bit with, you know, conditioning and baseball and stuff like that, but running slow is going to make you run slow.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we talk about it with our athletes at DST, a lot of things we test our 10 yard starts a lot. One of the things we talk about is those first three steps, you have to be patient in those steps. You have to be as aggressive as possible, but patient at the same time. And I think a lot of people just try to, they've been taught, you know, 90-90 with the arms and just swing the arms fast. And we're trying to teach them, you know, get the hand up, shield the sun from your eyes, throw the hands back on the start. Don't worry about like trying to chop your arms real quick, because that's going to just with your cross extensive reflex, it's going to end up shortening up your stride. And then the other part of it is, you know, while front side mechanics is probably one of the more important aspects of sprinting, especially in acceleration. When I say front side mechanics, I don't mean you're covering ground on the front side. You're covering the ground on the back side. You're forcing, the force into the ground is what covers ground. We're not reaching and pulling, but we have to be in a good strike position on the front side in order to allow us to produce the force quickly through the ground behind us. So it's just, it's one of those things where it's just a misunderstanding of what's actually happening. And I think when the more we can, you know, not talk judge, like in a judgy way to the athletes or any parents, but take the time to just explain it logically, because it's really a logical concept. It's just never thought about in that way.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you just mentioned. I've learned, like, I get frustrated just the same probably, but mm-hmm. like actually sitting down and giving like a well thought out scientific based answer the simplest way you can is, it really does go a long way. Like we have fun on Twitter, and like I'll get condescending just to like, it drives the point home a little bit more, because there are some people out there that are still zealots, unfortunately, for the, you know, things we're speaking against. So you do need to be like that sometimes. But when it comes to parents and kids, like when a kid trains with you, especially if we're talking younger, you know, you need to really ensure that they get why they're doing what they're doing and what's working and what makes them get the results they're looking for. It's just so important, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, we're coaches, so we should coach, we should teach. Like if they don't know, especially a younger athlete, if they don't know, like how are they going to know if you don't teach them? And with parents, a lot of times it's just that they're not informed. It's not that they don't get it or they don't care. It's just that they haven't been taught that either. They do other things for a living. So it's on us to teach and coach. And, you know, I fall short on that. I'm the same way. I get super condescending on Twitter because I like to be a troll sometimes. it's just, you know, it's how it is. And I get frustrated in person. I've vented to people about it before. But honestly, when we step back and look at it, that's something where all of us coaches can look ourselves in the mirror and see if we need to make improvements there. Because really, it's you got to be able to teach. And it's usually just a misunderstanding. And, you know, where I can draw the line is if we explain the process and we feel like it's been thoroughly covered and there's still not a lot of buy-in, well, all right, well, maybe this isn't the place for you. Like, I think people, coaches, other training places, get to the point of they're hustling, so they want to please everybody. They want everyone coming in. They want to be the guy everyone wants to train with, which is a great thing to be. But at the same time, you know, if there's not going to be buy into the process, it's going to cause more headaches down the road that we're not ready for. So like even when I've done it in the past, you see it where you just kind of put up with people instead of teaching them, and then they go somewhere else and the word is that you didn't work on what they wanted to work on. Well, okay, but I didn't educate them on why that's not what they really wanted in the first place. You know, I didn't do my part. So I think if we can educate athletes, parents, coaches alike, then, because a lot of what we talk about, it's not rocket science. Neither me or you has had the formal schooling, right? So I don't think. I think we're both business majors, correct?
Wow. Do you want to be completely honest with you? I had literally no idea we had that in common.
Yeah.
I kind of want to hit on that now. I didn't have that in there because I didn't know. I'm adding that as a – I'm literally – the outline is in front of me, and I'm adding that in. Talk
about, you could probably hear me typing on the mic, talk about going to business school and getting
there. You go.
Yeah, we're gonna hit that at the end. All right, so continue. Sorry, but I'm glad I found that out.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just goes down to the fact that all this stuff, it is hard to learn, and a lot of it is, you start to learn that there's a lot of science principles, and then there's a lot of art to it. But a lot of it is understood by, I'm sure, me and you, more than what we would have ever learned in a textbook. It's through experience, logic, reading research, applying it to what we actually see day to day, and then coming up with a reasoning. And once we have that reasoning, it's our hypothesis. We can test it and we see results. And we can, I think what a benefit of not having the formal exercise science or human performance is that we know how we needed to hear it. So
yes, you nailed that on the head. You hit the nail on the head there. I've said that to people before. I picked what like I thought I needed to know at first versus getting that whole like traditional schooling.
Mm-hmm. And so we can do the same thing for our parents, athletes, and coaches. But I think sometimes our ego gets the best of us, and we want to be, well, we know this and you don't know, just trust. When, and I probably have said that in the last couple weeks, but when I really should be looking myself in the mirror and be like, hey, listen, like they don't know. You didn't know when you started. Teach them the way you would have needed to be taught.
Yeah. I think that, man, I love when I hear things that I like, I'll harp on them. So forgive me for that. But like, I never thought of it. Well, maybe I have, but I haven't put it in like the terms of thinking it like that. But like the idea that as guys that like didn't go through that formal schooling and have like that quote unquote pedigree, so to speak, you know, as strength conditioning coaches, like I know personally speaking, like coming up through the field, like I mentioned DeFranco probably the fifth time this episode, but, I should get royalties from him. But I mentioned him because like I basically looked at a guy like that and I said, what did he, like, what sources did he, look for, you know, to get better as a coach? Like, I see him, I like the style that he does, like, it's no BS, like, the results are through the roof, it's just like a very tried and true approach, and I started to see that, it matched up with a lot, you know, more of the people that were, like, quote unquote, the elite of the industry. So like, you know, to your point, I realized, hey, that's the way I want to go. And that's the stuff that I want to learn. But I filtered out the other stuff because I realized that it wasn't really needed. Right. So we have that background. We can then explain it to people a lot easier than maybe some others can, because we had to kind of filter, some of that out from like that non-traditional standpoint. So I think that's just a really good point.
Appreciate it. Yeah. No, 100% agree with that.
It's crazy. I never really thought about it like that until you, maybe I have in a sense, but like I couldn't really think of a way to conceptualize it and way to, you know, say it. But, it's just so true. Like we, you know, people like me and you like need to be able to, understand that and be able to explain things. And I guess that's all along. Maybe I've, you know, never realized why I'm able to relate to people and get these, you know, ideas over to kids in an easier way. Cause I kind of understand like the Spark Notes version of it, so to speak.
Right. And that's a great way to put it. The Spark Notes version. I use the term a lot, but the term jargon, a lot of people like kind of make fun of me for saying it too much, but I was saying like, we don't want to get over jargony. Cause I know when I was an athlete, if people start getting technical jargony with me, my eyes went crossed and I was not listening. But if I can relate it in a simple way, like when I'm talking about energy systems, that's one of the most boring topics to talk about.
Yep.
But
analogies are really good when it comes to energy systems, I've learned.
Right. And so, yeah, we use going back to Pete Wilkening, one of my mentors, was he used an analogy of just like a construction site. He's like, that's your, you know, that's your creatine phosphate. That's your ATP-CP. He's like, but then the roads going in and out of that construction site, bringing materials and taking out trash, that's your aerobic system. So he's like, you can soup up that construction site all you want, but if you don't have a good aerobic base, like you're not getting the materials in or out, so you're not going to move any better. It's going to be very short lived, souped up construction site. But if you have a tiny construction site and super highways, that does you no good anyway. So like you need both. You need to have an aerobic base big enough to get supplies in and out to support your ATP-CP. And that was always an analogy that stuck with me. And so I've always tried to think about things in analogies because it was able to. That's how it was taught to me, and that's how I was able to understand it. And I feel like that's a really easy way for people not in the field, parents, coaches, athletes, to actually understand, internalize, and accept what we're trying to teach, as opposed to us talking down at them going cross-eyed, and then being like, they just don't understand what I need.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, just like the you said jargon, like, are there times that as coaches we, you know, try to pat our ego a little bit and use the bigger terms? I feel like sometimes, like, I don't know, maybe you experience this too, because we're kind of come from the same background, but like that you had to prove yourself a little bit, you know, and talk with those terms because you feel like you weren't going to get the respect. Because people, like, if they knew from the get-go that you weren't the exercise science degree guy, that you felt you had to prove something to them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, no, 100%. And there's always a time and a place for jargon. Like, you can't – if we have an athlete that's coming to us and they're let's say they're coming from an injury, and a doctor comes to us and is, you know, trying to explain the dynamics of the injury, and we can't understand the technical terminology and we can't speak in those terms – we're not going to get a lot of respect. So you need to be able to do it. You need to have that in your back pocket. Like, if you don't know anatomy, like, you need to start over. But you should know, you should know anatomy. You should know the technical terms. You should know all that, but you should be able to relate it to an athlete and parents and sport coaches in a way that they can understand. It's just like a sport coach teach an athlete a skill. There's a lot of intricacies to any skill. Let's say swinging a bat, there's a lot of intricacies to external rotation of the hip, holding torsion, lead leg bracing. There's a lot of it there. You don't need to be able to relate that to the athlete. They need to know that you know it, but you need to be able to relate it in the simplest terms possible. So I think that's been something that people like us with our background, we have a bit of a knack for, but it doesn't mean that you don't need to know what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Like you said, it's always like time and place. And obviously people don't like to talk about things in terms of like, oh, it depends, because it requires a lot more thought. But like, that's part of being a coach, is to be smart enough to understand when the time is right to actually like whip out that, you know, terminology, so to speak, that's needed, versus the times where it's like, all right, like, this 12-year-old doesn't need to hear me talk about the vertical stiffness of my, you know, limb when it makes contact with the ground, you know, in terms of the plans we're going for in the triphasic phase of the eccentric. Like, they're not going to know what the hell that means. Like, right. That means nothing to them. You want to tell them that we got to get better at making them, you know, put more force into the ground. I'll tell like a young hockey kid, like, make it fun. Oh, we're going to, like, they're going to be cracks in the ice out there when you skate, because you're going to be so strong. Oh, like, right. At least gives them something to shoot for. Like, it's not, obviously not realistic, but like, they understand that the premise of what we're training for is to make their stride stronger.
Yeah, absolutely. It's simple. It's like, you're not, like you just said, you're not going to talk to a youth athlete about like how eccentrics are going to affect the pronation angle of the muscle. You're not going to talk about the aponeurosis and the interface of the muscle to the connective tissue and how collagen lays down after an injury.
All right, now you're just showing off, dude. But no, but like we said in the beginning about like not prescribing whatever, all the different analogies we use. But it's like, I had a good friend of mine way back in the industry say to me, you know, we're not going to break out Tudor Bompa's elite levels of high sports performance programming for the 9-year-old who can't do a body weight squat.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. 100%.
So I don't want to, you know, get off on too much of a tangent. I kind of want to rein us in a little bit, but I mean, I'm having a lot of fun, but I wanted to talk, we talked about speed obviously a lot, but I wanted to get into baseball start specifically, you know, being guys that work with a lot of baseball players, but let's just say it off the bat. I want to talk about why the crossover step sucks. I still can't even believe it's talked about or demonstrated. And I'm going to let you take the floor on this. Why does it suck? Why should you stop teaching it?
Well, there's a couple parts to that. So it's a multi-part question with a multi-part answer. So one of the things that I don't quite understand right now is, I've taught the crossover step forever. But one of the things that I don't understand is when we bring up, you know, killing the crossover step, it's not only the athletes, but coaches and parents look at us kind of cross-eyed because they feel like we're the outlier trying to do that, when really it's the mainstream. Like,
yes, that's true. Actually,
this is where the field is. Like, I've talked to anytime I say I'm saying we at DST. Anytime we talk to strength coaches with different organizations, pro baseball, they all show this research that they're doing on the drop step or plow step or whatever you want to call it, being by far superior to the crossover step. And there's a couple of reasons to it. And then just to preface this is that if I've got a baseball player that is a, let's say, a 10-year vet in MLB, which I'm currently working, you know, at DST, we're currently, I don't believe, working with anybody of that population. But if I'm working with them and they're a base stealer and they've done the crossover step their whole life, odds are I'm not going to try to change
it. Yeah, that's a great point, actually. Yeah. I just forget, excuse me for 1 second before I cut you off, but I saw a video from, I don't think it was Stu McMillan per se. It was a trainer from Altus. Basically working with Paul Goldschmidt last year, and people were like jumping all over the guy for why are you letting him do the crossover? I'm like, it's Paul Goldschmidt. The guy's 31 years old or whatever how old he is. Like, he's probably been doing that for a long time, and they realize it's no point in getting him out of it.
Right. And honestly, Paul Goldschmidt,
and he's not stealing bases.
So who cares? Yeah. Like, we're talking about the margins here. So like the stuff, like it's when you can, it's a guy that speed is one of their tools. And it's youth athletes and trying to change the thought process in baseball. So in strength conditioning, there's nobody that's going to nobody with credibility is going to advocate the crossover step. Like, it just isn't happening anymore. Like, everyone is advocating this. I lean away from calling it a false step because I try to differentiate, because people hear false and it just has a negative connotation already.
There is, there are differences. Like, the drop and the false are different. Like,
right.
Yeah. Right. Like you said, like, speaking to that point as well, like there are differences. Like, and I also, I've had athletes that don't even, maybe they'll just lift their heel a little bit and kind of spin around on the front side to, you know, kind of get, where they need to go. And it all depends on what they need, but go ahead. Like, you don't call it the false step, which I agree with, because it gives kind of like a negative context.
Right. So we try to call it like a plyo drop step is what we try to call it. And one way we get high school athletes on board with it is we tell them, hey, when you're testing, and this is insider secret here, if you're testing your 60 a perfect game, this will get you a tenth of a second on your time, because you're losing ground, but you're able to start from further back and no one's going to call you on it. But basically what's happening is the negative of a crossover step is usually the stance is a little wide. So it takes time for the athlete to get their center of mass over their lead leg or their drive leg. The second part of it is, so that's one part. The second part of it is, it's usually kind of a dead leg. They're sitting in that half squat, if you will, and they're losing that reflexive ability. But then the things that happen with the plyo drop step, the way we call it, is one, you're getting that foot back under your center of mass quicker than you would if you were shifting your weight. Two, there's that plyometric effect where you're utilizing the connective tissue, not just like the brute force of the muscle. You're able to clear your hips quicker. It creates a positive shin angle immediately, instead of just getting under your center of mass through the lean and then leaning even more and more and more and then finally getting a positive shin angle. You're able to create a better lever because you're not pushing from the side of your foot as much as you would in a crossover step. Your body lean is instantly set. And so all of those things are positives. And so you're able to produce more force before hitting the ground. So you're not just pushing against that object at the start. You're able to build some speed into it. So the way I've kind of tried to teach it is, you know, if you're in a base stealing position, you still stagger like you always would in a traditional crossover step. But the first move is that it's like a slight lift with the front leg and a push with the back leg. Yes. And then a punch with the front leg.
That extension is so key. You know who Jason Kanzler is?
I don't.
Okay. So he, I think he got a job in the Houston Astros organization last year, but he was a guy that opened up a lot of this to me, in terms of exposing me to like some really good videos to use as like demos, like old major leaguers and stuff. You mentioned that push off the back leg, right? Jose Canseco, literally, like, he got such good drive. It almost looked like he was like triple extending his backside.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like I ever, that changed the teach for me. That really changed the entire thing for what I went about in terms of like trying to teach it, because that is so important in terms of shifting the center of mass over, you know, and even in front of that lead leg and that ankle.
Right. And then it's about, you know, trying not to lift that front leg that high. You don't have to lift that high. You still want to keep close to the ground, but from there, everything stays the same. It's just, it takes a little bit of coordination to get used to it, but it's better. And you threw out the Astros, a guy by the name of Dan Howells, who is their new, I don't know his technical title, but he's like their head of strength conditioning. And he came over from England, where he worked with a lot of Olympic sports and rugby, but you know, he came out to the facility last year and he was talking about it. And the only reason I've ever coached the crossover step, you know, outside of at first believing the crossover step was the way to go, cause I was a baseball player and that's what I was taught.
Yep. Me too. Yep.
The outside of that, the only reason I would tell people this, the only reason we even teach the crossover step, in base stealing is because coaches will get mad if they see you do anything else. So we're going to coach you to do what your coach wants the best way possible. But now it's gotten to the point where it's readily available knowledge and data. There's no excuse. Like, we need to be coaching this drop step, this plyo step, whatever you want to call it. But you're right. That back leg is more important. It's not just attacking back with the lead leg, but gaining some ground with that back leg by pushing through the ground. And that creates less time that front foot has to be off the ground in order to attack under that center of mass. So it's a bit of a coordination challenge, but if we can start teaching youth athletes now, then they're going to be so much better off for it down the road. And we need to start affecting high school athletes and college athletes, and, you know, even our minor league and pro athletes start to work on that. And I think a lot of reasons people don't in training is because if you're using a laser start, you know, it gives faster times when you use a laser start because it takes a while to cross that threshold. And I'm like, well, then, you know, think about it logically, your testing means is off. Start every athlete from like a yard back. And what does it matter what the time is? Like, are you improving it or not?
Yes. That's a big one, actually. Like, you know, making sure that, you know, at the end of the day, if what you're testing is consistent in terms of how you're testing it and it improves, then that's all you care about.
Exactly. I don't care if, you know, he's doing the drop step, so he takes a little longer to cross the threshold, so he's running a 1.48. I don't for any second believe that he's an actual 1.48 10-yard start, but it doesn't matter. We're training. So if I get a 1.48 and then next week I can get a 1.47 using the same means, then we're improving.
Yes.
At the end of the day, I don't care. It's kind of like weights, right? 400 pounds, like, who cares what? That's just a number. Is it affecting change in our athletes or not?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the idea that people would let that influence, you know, what they're teaching in terms of, it's like you said, if you can make sure that it's just done the same way every time, and like, I don't, if it's in the doors of the walls of like, where you're training and it's done the same way every time and it improves and you're getting better. And however they test it at the showcase you're going to or the field you're at, like, it's going to get better there too. It's like, it's coming off the same way. Like, it's just like how whatever your 10 improves. If your 10 goes down a tenth of a second, your whole 60 is going to go down a tenth of a second at least.
Right. And just going off of what you said earlier with Jose Canseco, one of the parts that really opened my eyes was Lee Fiocchi. When I was just working for him over at our West facility, he had me put together a video of like steel starts, different guys doing different steel starts. And I came across different videos of different guys doing different things. But a good example is Dave Roberts. He was a crossover guy. But, you know, he's a guy you would never try to coach out of that. But you look at the greats, and instead of saying, oh, they were just freaks and excusing their technique and saying, oh, it's bad technique, but that guy's a freak. Instead of doing that, why not learn from how they move naturally? So like Ricky Henderson, his foot came back. Carl Crawford, who worked with Lee at the time, while I was doing video with him a lot, his foot came back. Michael Bourne, and he's a guy we've worked with for years, even though he thought about doing crossovers, when he was in a game, his foot came back. And it's how they move naturally, and it's part of what made them great. It's not obviously the only thing. They're obviously really good athletes and really fast. But, you know, why not learn from those athletes as opposed to saying, oh, that guy's a freak, but listen to me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's like the whole, you know, hands on the knees versus hands overhead thing. What's the body go to when it needs to be where it needs to be?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really well said. The Michael Bourne thing was a great example. Like, if he was trying to do with the crossover, but when it came time to actually have to steal a base, his body told him where it needed to be, and that's what he did. He did. Right. He dropped, and that was kind of where he was. I mean, I don't really think anything else needs to be said in terms of the baseball star. That kind of just hit, you know, the listeners, my listeners at least, have heard me talk about it, you know, enough, honestly. So getting your perspective was kind of what I wanted on that. So that was awesome. So at the end here, I'll be honest, like, I wanted to get into a little bit of in-season training and conditioning, but again, stuff I've talked about, like, a lot. You being a strength coach that, you know, went to business school as well. Like, I, again, just learning that like 15 minutes ago, and getting into the industry is something I'd honestly rather just replace that with and talk to you about that. Cause I think it's valuable. I have a lot of listeners, believe it or not, that are trying to get, you know, into the industry as coaches who don't, you know, come from the traditional, background. So I think it's important to cover that. So kind of give me an idea of like where you're coming from. Like, you know, where'd you go to business school? Kind of how that manifest and, you know, anything in particular that kind of helped you get your foot in the door?
Yeah, so I was a really mediocre athlete in high school and got a small scholarship to a small college in Nebraska called Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska.
Okay.
And so that's where I went to undergrad, and I didn't get a master's, so I don't know why I even said undergrad there. But that's where I did my school, and really I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I just was playing ball in college, and I figured at some point, you know, business seems pretty broad. Like, I'm going to need to be able to produce money at some point. And so figured business degree to go with it. But like I said, I was just kind of lost. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And then going in from my junior year to my senior year, I had an ankle injury and I had a shoulder injury. They weren't serious, but they were lingering. And I got connected with Lee, who had just moved to the Houston area, and started training with him as an athlete, actually. And after that summer, I was exposed to a lot of new ideas, and I always thought training was just working out at that point and just getting in better shape. And so he opened my eyes to a lot of things. My ankle got better. My shoulder was good. And I realized that's kind of the path I wanted to go, but it was just too late to change my degree plan. There was just no way I was going to do that. So I started asking Lee a lot. He was really a mentor for me in that process, and just – so him recommending books to read or taking time to explain things to me. And then eventually after college, I coached for a year, decided I didn't want to do that. And I got, Lee offered me an internship. And then actually after that summer, I always kid him about this, but he actually kind of fired me after my summer internship, told me that, he wasn't going to be able to facilitate my employment past the summer. And so I was kind of like, I didn't know what to do. And at the time, his business partner, Adam Cyphers, I told him about my conversation with Lee, and he had to talk him into letting me do a boot camp. So the way it was, you know, I learned was because I was never going to be able to catch up just on the technical schooling side. Mm-hmm. So the way I learned, obviously, you know, I got my certifications, I did all that, but was learning from Lee, watching as what he did and how he did it. And then learning through experience of, okay, this athlete responds to this, doesn't respond to this. Some people, for whatever reason, this resonates with people. Learning through experience, but then also, like you said, looking at the people who are successful. You don't have to figure out how to be successful in the field. People have done it.
Yeah.
And they've made all the mistakes already. And so, like, there's nothing that's going to be new for your experience, really. So what I did was I watched Lee. I looked at Eric Cressy. I looked at how he ran his platform and how he went about things. Ron Wolforth at the Texas Baseball Ranch is more of a throwing, but they do some strength work there as well. And learning from him and learning from, you know, I just looked at who I admired. So DeFranco was definitely one for me. Louis Simmons, even.
Yeah. Yep.
Westside Barbell, and just, you know, trying to look to people, see one, how they conducted themselves and try to mimic that. So it's not a fake it till you make it, really, but it was more dress for the job you want. Right. So
yeah,
this is how the best present themselves. I'm going to try to present myself in that same way. So when I started making exercise videos, I might not have understood all the terminology, but before I would do like the exercise of the week type videos, I'd go research it. So I had a clue what I was talking about. But I tried to present myself kind of like Eric Cressy, right? So he did a good job of communicating complex things very simply, even though he was using a lot of technical terminology. And so I wanted to be able to have that skill set. And so just learning from them, that was kind of my path. And then, you know, over the years, it's not like I wouldn't consider myself an expert in anything, but over the years, just being able to pick up on things and learn through failures, that's really all you can do. And then when people ask questions, don't try to BS them. Don't try to tell them, you know what, you know everything, because you don't, and I don't. And so if you don't know, just tell an athlete you don't know, but you're going to research it. And then that's something Lee always told me. But the key is you have to actually go research it and come back with some kind of an answer. You can't just say, I don't know, and I'll go research it and then let it die. You go research it, you learn, you build trust with the athlete. The athlete trusts that you're actually putting in the work. No one expects you to know everything, but they expect you to care. So it helps build trust, but it also helps you learn. And so all you can do is not be afraid of learning and not be afraid of failure.
Absolutely. Like, if you don't go back and look at your programming from 3 or 4 years ago as a coach and be like, holy shit, what the hell was I thinking? Like, you're not doing it right.
Yeah. And I think we have a corrective exercise kind of program we call re-education. So after the assessment, we have re-education that's corrective. I go back and I look at some of the stuff I was programming 4 years ago, and I was just like, man, I was a lunatic. This is crazy amounts of volume on their strength, speed, and corrective work. Like, there's no way I should have been programming like this. So,
yeah, no, for sure. I actually, I turned the office in my house into like a little podcast studio, and I have a bookshelf with all my like old S&C books. And, I actually used to program on paper. Believe it or not, I'm not 60 and didn't start in the 1970s. I started in 2016 and yet still was just old school enough to write on paper. And I don't know, I guess I felt like it gave me like a better idea to, like, you know, at the time I felt like writing things made it easier for me to, you know, convey my thoughts, whatever the reason was. And I'm actually, this has inspired me to go back, and I have a binder of all like the first 6 months of programs that I did when I started. And I'm sure some of it will give me a laugh for sure. But you're right. Like, I tell people all the time that reach out to me, like, how did you get in the field without having the degree and, get your foot in the door? It's like, you got to one, take chances. But there's going to be points where like you're put in a position to maybe do something where you don't feel like you're ready to do it, but you have to do it. Like, I was basically told, like, you know, I interned for someone similar situation as you, and, you know, they were my mentor, so to speak. And basically we're like, hey, we're pleased with the, you know, job you're doing with, basically it, kind of a long story short type of thing. You know, my childhood physical therapist and a guy that's rehabbed me from like every surgery that I've ever had growing up playing sports and, you know, through high school and college, gave me an internship opportunity to basically just hang around their practice and like learn from them with the patients. And then when the patients were discharged from PT, I would give them like free strength training in the back. And they liked the job that I was doing so much that they basically said, you know, we have an opportunity to, you know, work, do some work with a hockey place. Do you want to be the strength coach? And I was like, I am in no means prepared to do this. And the guy said to me, like, you know, fake it till you make it, in the sense of like, you're smart enough at least to get going with it. Like, go in there and own it. Like, you are a 10-year veteran coach. And I learned a lot on the way, and I was probably good enough to start the job back then, but like, just because like it was very basic, but nowhere near where I was now. And if I looked at myself from when I started and said, this is all the stuff you're going to know in 4 years, I would have been like, oh my God, I don't know anything. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, if someone had told, you know, 22 year old me that like, this is what you're going to know in 4 years that you don't know right now, I would have like, I would have been screwed. I would have been like scared shitless. Like, just not knowing that. Right. So I think my advice would, and kind of like what you're saying is like, you know, take the chance and accept the fact that you're going to have to maybe get into some opportunities where you're going to have to learn on the job.
Absolutely. And I mean, just using an example you just said, you got to do things you weren't necessarily ready to do. One of my first, when I was interning my first day, Lee had the speed group going outside. We were working on the hill, and I was barely learning how to read the speed sheet. And he said, hey, I got to run inside really quick. Can you take him through the warm up? And then I'll be back. And I was like, okay, yeah, no problem. I get through the warm up and Lee's not around. So I was like, all right, well, go get some water, come back. They go get water, come back. Lee's not there. And so I pretty much had this whole hour by myself with like 25 athletes, and I barely knew what I was doing. But like you said, you kind of know more they don't know you don't know, first off, and you know more than
yeah, them. Yeah, yeah.
If you just command the room, have some energy, say it confidently, you're not gonna kill someone. And so just go at it. But then also, like, don't, and this isn't just for athletes with different backgrounds, like, or coaches with different backgrounds, like business school or anything like that, but any coach entering the private sector, just have no expectations. You can't go in, I don't know if you go through this or not, but we go through resumes of people wanting positions at X rate or X salary or whatever. I'm like, listen, this is not how the private sector works.
No. Like, at the private sector, you're like, whatever you have for me at this point, like, I'll build it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what we'll say is, like, here's where we're lacking. You could jump in there. But even then, I'm not going to just hire you. You're going to have to do some sort of apprenticeship
or carve something out. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause we, it's a relationship business. I'm not going to trust you. I don't care what your resume says. I've seen some great resumes attached to some crappy people. But I've seen some crappy resumes be with the best coaches, be the best coaches we've ever had. Like a Dennis Coink at our West location, he didn't have a resume. He worked at a restaurant, but he's been one of the best coaches we've had. And I could go on and on from him to Chelsea, to Jimmy, to Sammy, to Ryan. Like, they all have different backgrounds, and it's one of those things where you gotta earn it, and you can't have expectations. So we had an intern apply last summer that asked if there was a guarantee of employment at the end of the internship. We said no. And he was like, well, I really need a guarantee. I'm like, well, I mean, sorry, man, you're not going to get that in the private sector. You might be able to get that somewhere else, but it's just not going to happen. And I don't know what conditions people to believe that, but you got to earn it. You got to be willing to do it for nothing. But then once you're able to earn your spot, don't wear your work as a badge of honor. Like, don't wear your long days and your hours as a badge of honor. Every strength coach in the world has done it, myself included.
Yep.
But it gets you nowhere. It just builds resentment and makes people, you're either trying to get sympathy or you're trying to show how hard you work. But everyone in the industry does it. Like, don't wear it as a badge of honor. It's just a part of being a strength coach, and find ways to make your schedule better and make your athletes better,
Absolutely. And don't feel like if you somehow find ways to make your hours a little more human, that you're not working as hard as somebody else, because maybe they're just not smart enough to be a little more kind to their bodies or their minds, so to speak. I've learned that as well.
Absolutely. 100%. It's one of those things where, you don't want everybody in this industry that is good is a grinder and a worker, and they're going to work, and they feel bad about going home at 6 o'clock.
Yeah. It feels weird. Yeah.
it just feels weird. It's like uncomfortable. But one, you don't want to make people feel bad about that for them, because this industry also has an extremely high rate of burnout. And I forget the stat, Josh Graber, our business operations director, brought up a stat to us the other day. He said, it's something like 90% of coaches in this field are in a different field by the time they turn 40, and it's because of burnout. And so if you can prevent staff and yourself from burning out in this field, you can have a long career. But don't make people feel bad about having human hours, but don't relish in that you have long hours, because sooner or later that catches up to you.
Yeah.
And then you're going to burn out, and you don't want to do that either. So take care of yourself, take care of the staff, and you can have a successful team for a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even just something I thought of while you were talking too, that I wanted to add in on my end, was like, I think back now, like, I would sit here and rip apart my programming. Like, I remember, I'll never forget, you mentioned that example of, like, you were, looking over the group of guys doing speed work and you had to kind of step in. I remember being told by my mentor, who's still a mentor to me and that I work with, hey, you're going to, work with this hockey organization, go build a year program for 18, 19, 20 year old Division I bound hockey players. And I was like, I remember like going on like my Microsoft Word and typing out like the most over the top, like way too detailed program, thinking that it would go anything like that, not knowing that like nothing ever goes the way you want it to go, and things are changed and schedules change and all that kind of stuff. But, having to do that, and I think to myself, like, how picky I would be now with like looking at my programming back then, but it would still get a lot of results. Like,
absolutely,
as imperfect as it was, and as much I've changed since then, like, I could probably, if I was forced to use that same programming with kids now, as much as disgruntled as I would be about it, it would still get a hell of a lot of results.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't beat yourself up about programming. There's no perfect way to do it, right? So it's just, when I look back on it, like when we'd go through our triphasic, let's say an eccentric below 80% triphasic phase, one of my big things was I had way too much volume in there doing 6 to 8 second eccentrics throughout the lift, whether it was main lift, secondary, auxiliary, didn't matter. Everything was like 6 second eccentric. So it's just like, looking back at it, I cringe, but we had guys gain some mass and gain speed and power. And it was just one of those things, though, looking back, it's not that that didn't work. It was just that we could have gotten away with a lot less and a lot more simplified. We didn't have to do all of that.
Yeah. And I mean, it got the job done now, but you made it more effective. It made it more efficient.
Yeah. It's more efficient now. It's more effective. Maybe you trim the margins and make it a little better.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, man, I want to open this to you, because I always do this to all my guests, but if there's anything you wanted to leave the listener with, we covered a lot, but, you know, any, you know, parting thoughts, if you wanted to kind of wrap up anything we talked about, you know, floor is yours.
I appreciate that. One, I'd like to thank you for having me on. It's been awesome, man. I've had a lot of fun. We should do this again.
Absolutely.
Quickly, because I know we had it on the agenda. I'll be very bullet point. In season lifting, it's about keeping volume low, intensity high, microdosing, and treating each athlete as they need, because not every game is the same, especially in baseball. Some people, they'll play four innings. Some people will get, you know, strike out four times. Some people hit three triples. So it's just about being able to adjust in season, but keep the intensity high, volume low. And then just to say this is, like, as a strength coach, it's never about the individual. It's always about the team. And I've always said, like, I'm nothing without the team that we have around us. And, you know, each of us push each other each day to get better. And I'm no exception. Like, I'm very humbled to work with the people I work with at our North campus, our West campus, our South campus, and either out in Arizona where we're at. And I just, you know, want to say that I love my guys. And if you can build relationships like that, I think it's a rare thing, especially in our industry. And I've been really appreciative of that. And, you know, just look to build relationships instead of trying to be successful. Our motto for this year at DST is significance over success. And if you can strive for that, you know, the rest will be there.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That's really well said. And I think the thing I agree with you on the most is we got to do this again, because I think this was awesome. You know, I rarely do. I do 90-minute episodes where, like, I don't feel like it was 90 minutes. That felt like it was 20. That was great. And I really appreciate you coming on, and I'm really excited to get this one out.
I appreciate it, man. I'm excited too. And I know we could probably sit there here and talk for hours about random nonsense. And I think
maybe we'll do an episode like that next time.
Yeah. Just random things that come into our head.
Yeah. I actually, maybe that's an idea, like, not even like outline the whole thing and just kind of start talking and see where it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in.
Let All me right, know. Man. Kev, thanks, man. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast, brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DiFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.